All right, so this is the 9/11 Truth, another Deep State Crimes Teleconference for the 27th of July, 2016. Ken Freeland facilitating and Craig McKee, Secretary. First item on the agenda, as always, is the approval of the minutes from the previous teleconference. Are there any objections to approving the minutes?
Do you want me to do the roll call first, though, Ken?
Oh, I beg your pardon. Thank you, Craig. Please have a roll call for the record.
Okay, yeah, here's who I have already written down. Craig McKee, Ken Freeland, Adam Ruff, Tim Michael, Dennis Cimino, John O'Malley, Roger Borys, Dan Hennen, Wayne Costi, Jerry Turner, Xander Arena, Martin Bruce, Barbara Honegger, Dave Schlesinger, Richard Gage, Sheila Casey, David Cole, Kat McGuire, and Nita Renfrew. Did I get everybody?
Yep.
Sounds like
so,
it.
Yep. Thank you. And with that done, then any objections to approving the minutes from the previous teleconference that have circulated? Hearing none, we'll take the minutes for approved and move on to tonight's draft agenda to see if we can approve it. I need to mention in passing that even though it's not on the agenda proper, in the narrative I mentioned that Richard would be speaking about TAP, but that was due to a miscommunication. TAP is apparently not part of the 9/11 Truth, and therefore Richard will not be addressing that in his comments this evening. So that minor change. Any other changes to the agenda? Hearing none, then we'll take the draft agenda for our working document tonight and move forward to the first item. Richard's time is very short tonight, so we're going to put him on first right away. Richard is probably someone in the 9/11 Truth movement that absolutely needs no introduction, but in case we have any newbies on the call, Richard is the founder and CEO of AE 9/11 Truth, and through his speaking tours and videography, has spread the 9/11 Truth gospel worldwide. We welcome him back to the teleconference, and he's going to update us tonight on what's going on with AE 9/11 Truth. Go ahead, Richard.
Thanks, Ken. It turns out that I can stay for the call, so I'm delighted to do that. So no rush after all tonight in particular. Knowing that, do you want to shuffle anything on the agenda? Because
You're first, so you know, go ahead. We've got you scheduled first. We're going with the agenda.
All right. Well, I'm very excited to address this group very briefly on the 15th anniversary events that we have planned in New York on Saturday, September 10th, and Sunday, September 11th. We have booked the Great Hall in the Cooper Union, and we were just very, very, very lucky. I can tell you that it's because there's just no way we could make the finances on this work out if we didn't have a donation from somebody and B, a mistake on the part of the Cooper Union where they charged us half of what they should, which is extraordinary. So we've been, in addition to that, we've got Daniel Sheehan keynoting this conference at the end of Saturday night, and this is the litigator of the Silkwood case, Karen Silkwood, Kerr McGee, the Iran-Contra affair, and several other notable national cases. One in particular I'm missing. There we go. Thanks, Barb. And Barb knows Daniel Sheehan personally. In fact, Barb, would you just take a minute just to tell people how exciting this is and who this man is that we're so lucky to have?
Yeah, it really is. And I should say that I invited him and got him to say yes. Danny Sheehan is a world-class attorney, and if anyone has not yet gotten his book called The People's Advocate, it is a must read for everyone in our truth movement, whether it's 9/11 Truth or JFK Assassination Truth or RFK Assassination Truth or Karen Silkwood Truth whatever. Daniel Sheehan is literally Daniel in the lion's den of the deep state. He is the attorney who has won his cases. And his book, The People's Advocate, goes through case by case. It begins with the beginning of his life, but it then goes into his legal training at Harvard University. But then beyond that, he goes into each chapter or group of chapters. He's on one case after another that has made a tremendous difference both nationally and internationally that he has won. And the sole exception was the Iran-Contra case. That's about the last fifth of the book. And I highly recommend that when everybody gets it, that they go straight to the last fifth of the book, to the Iran-Contra case, because that was the case that stared into the abyss of the deep state the most directly. And you will be shocked at what the deep state was willing to do to make sure that no one could possibly win that case. So it's very exciting that he said yes, and I got him to say yes when I did Judge in Quasimodo, and he said yes, and then Danny Sheehan said yes after that.
This is a part of my presentation, so please let Barbara finish.
Oh, no, that's it.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Barb. And so he brings thousands of people into the 9/11 truth movement with this foray into the lion's den of the 9/11 truth movement. He's now entered another part of the deep state. Not that he's unfamiliar with it. Barb has been working with him for years on this, but it appears as if he's coming out of the closet. And that's all we can say for right now. And that'll bring a lot of attention to the 9/11 truth movement from the mainstream and from circles that he frequents or that follow him. Any more about that, Barb?
Well, it's just he's a world-class attorney. And wait until you read his book, The People's Advocate. I mean, he's not only the Terrence Oakwood case and the Iran-Contra case, but the American Sanctuary case during the Vietnam War, the Pentagon Papers case on behalf of the New York Times, and you could go on and on and on. And now he is jumping into 9/11 truth. Thank God.
Yeah, it's incredible. And he will be the keynote speaker Saturday night. He'll also be sitting as one of the eight panelists all day Sunday discussing legal strategies to advance the 9/11 truth cases and form new ones. And he's got some ideas for some new ones himself. And he may, well, I shouldn't say anymore. And I don't know, I'm not at liberty to, I will be maybe next call. But it's very exciting. Ferdinand Impasimato, the honorary Supreme Court President of Italy, will be keynoting in the morning on Saturday. Very exciting. Also, he'll be talking about false flag operations, particularly Operation Gladio. So these two are the heavyweights. They're heavyweight legal professionals that have world-class gravitas. And along with others, like Lionel, who has a radio program, is an attorney who is also all over 9/11, not all over, but very, very excited. He had his own radio show, presented us 8/11 Truth after we got on C-SPAN. He was blabbing about it all over the place. Very excited. His name is Michael Lebron. He goes by Lionel Radio, or Lionel something, and he'll be there. He brings another set of audience members to the event. So we have a 3-hour technical presentation with experts that you all know: Stephen Jones, David Chandler, John Cole, myself, Graham McQueen, Stephen Dusterwald, who appeared in Expert Speak Out, will be presenting a midday Sunday, preceded by a legal strategy analysis by these eight attorneys, including Daniel Sheehan, Judge Impasimato, and concluding with their comments and strategies for the future and what to do with this evidence. The whole idea is that this evidence will be packaged, presented to grand juries, and more to our
direct involvement. It will be a package for us as activists to take to our local judge or governor, which the state, the federal code, Section 18, requires us to submit if we believe we have evidence of treason. So that will be packaged for us. That may take a few months following 9/11. But that's the action, the deliverable that will come from this conference, and we're very excited about that. There are other speakers that include Wayne Mattson, Michael J. Springman, probably Robert Steele, CIA whistleblower, and lots of analysis on the deep state and false flag ops, 28 pages. Anybody throwing anything else because I couldn't find
mine? Yeah, Richard, you've forgotten to mention William Pepper.
Oh, of course. William Pepper will be emceeing the Sunday event. Our own Dr. William Pepper, who litigated several important cases, was it all RLK and MLK on behalf of the family members, the family of Martin Luther King. In the case of MLK, he, of course, succeeded in winning a civil litigation that found that the government was directly involved in assassinating MLK, and the media, being as powerful as it is and the people being as asleep as they are, didn't pick it up and nothing happened. Well, not enough happened. What about RFK?
May I mention one other thing, Richard?
You said RLK. You meant RFK.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate that. Bart?
Yeah, you're conflating MLK and RFK.
Yeah,
I just wanted to... I'm not even sure you know this, Richard, but when we met with Judge Impazamoto last October, Danny Sheehan and myself, in Rome, he gave us a copy of his book, which is in Italian, unfortunately, of course, but it is on the Gladio operation, but he is very, very adamant and said so at the No to NATO conference that Danny and I attended in Rome last October. He was a keynote speaker, and he made it very clear that he believes the evidence points unmistakably towards 9/11 being an American Gladio operation, not only an inside job, but perpetrated by basically the Gladio team.
Oh, got it. Good point. So that's the subject
that
of his address.
To James Clark to get translated, Richard.
Great. Fantastic. And he will have a translator. We will be live streaming the entire event in a very professional way. We'll have two cameras. They'll be elevated. We'll be live mixing the live stream between the two cameras and a direct feed with this projector so that when they're slides, you can actually see them. Following each of the sessions, Google Hangouts, our platform for this endeavor, will be uploading automatically to YouTube each of the sessions. So people who purchase the tickets, I think we'll call it a donation, for live stream, we'll have 30-day access to all of these presentations, and they'll go public after 30 days. So that's very exciting to have a professional level archive and live stream. Alan Reese will be performing this. As he's done for the Left Forum and the Oakland Film Festival. Very exciting. Thanks again, Barb, for getting Alan all over that again. This is an incredible opportunity. In addition, it looks like we'll have some other videographers there to capture raw footage that we can keep in a database for a future documentary or DVD. Tickets are on sale now. You may have gotten the email from AE911Truth or seen it on Facebook. If you didn't get an email, that means you're not on our email list. And all you have to do is go to AE911Truth.org and click Sign Up for Email Newsletter. And you will get future emails about this subject. And maybe Ken can distribute the, if he hasn't already, I think he did, Ken, to your group, the email. The announcement of the New York event from AE 911 Truth.
No, haven't circulated it yet. If you want to, send us a copy for the minutes, we'll be sure to include it with the minutes so that everybody in the queue can see it. Okay.
Any questions or comments?
Send that to Craig. Before we get across questions and comments, I need to make a quick disclaimer here. First of all, Richard, this is really exciting and monumental undertaking. As we had planned to use our announcements today for local activities, anyone who doesn't have a local activity planned and isn't planning to go to New York might seriously consider doing a little house party with this or larger event with this live screen. It certainly suggests itself as a way to commemorate 9/11. Before we take questions and comments, I want to clarify that Richard is only here discussing this event, so all questions and comments will need to be on this subject. So who would like to be on the stack to ask a question or make a comment?
Xander.
Xander? Who else? Okay, Xander, go ahead.
Okay, just last clarification. I previewed the ticket price. It was like $20. Then that's like an online access, but it's also a door entry. So if I can find my way to New York, then it's the seat of one of the 800. But if I can't find my way to New York, then it's access to the live stream. Did I understand correctly?
No. We don't have tickets on sale for the live stream yet, but certainly any ticket anybody purchases for the door, for the seat, at the event and couldn't come, we would find a way for you to use those funds for the live stream, and I should make that clear in our invitation. Did that answer your question, Xander?
Yeah, perfectly. Thank you.
Okay. Great. Thanks. Good point. Let me also mention that the launch of the Truth Action Project will take place on Saturday. And that's one of the most exciting developments in the 9/11 Truth Movement, if you ask me, where the group which has been born out of AE 9/11 Truth is now independent and running fully, will be trying to amass grassroots local organizations all over the country, hundreds of them. And we're going to do everything we can to help that happen, including launching the project and endorsing the project on the afternoon of Saturday. Very, very exciting. Maybe, Bill, you want to add anything to that? I don't know if people know about TAP.
Okay, let's keep going.
That
was Bill Jacoby, who's supposed to be on the call. Maybe, Wayne, you want to say anything about TAP?
Well, thanks, Richard. I haven't any prepared remarks for us about the TAP, but we have launched our new URL. It's 911tap.org. My understanding is that it's up and running. It's been transferred from the 911truthoutreach.org that we've been using for the last couple of years. It has an events calendar. We're now posting events like this teleconference up there. We have a monthly meeting of our regional coordinators. We just had one of those. We're looking forward to, we've developed a strategic plan, which is available on our website, I believe. I haven't seen it yet, but stay tuned, and we'll be giving you some further information as it kind of develops. Thanks, over.
Tim here.
Could you please spell that? Is that TAP911TAP.org?
Yes, it stands for 911TruthActionProject.org.
Oh, got it.
Tim here. I just wanted to add that, yes, indeed, the 911tap.org website is up and functioning, and the events calendar is a very powerful events calendar, allows you to enter all kinds of information, including web banners and mobile web banners and anything you can think of to promote your event. And it actually has a conference call section, an agenda and minutes section, so that conferences like this can be made easily available to anybody, and any of the minutes that somebody missed the conference, it's easy for them to find that as well. And we also have a forum section that is going to be dedicated to not just an open public forum, but it's dedicated for people who want to discuss issues relevant to actions that are taking place in their region. So we have a forum set up for that, too. So we're looking forward to a lot of activity on this website.
Is that Tim Michael speaking?
That's Tim Michael.
Okay. Okay. Would anybody else like to make a comment or ask a question of Richard?
Dave Schlesinger.
Dave? Anybody else? Okay. Go ahead, Dave.
Yes. One of the questions I asked when Kelly and Andy were on a few months ago that I never got an answer to, and hopefully we can get an answer here, because I've been at odds with AE over them being willing to give out lists of petition
signers. I have to remind you, no, David, this is only
this about TAP. It's exactly about TAP.
It has to
exactly
be.
About TAP.
It must be, and it must be.
It
TAP,
is.
Okay?
They don't allow the grassroots organizers to receive lists of petition signers. And my question is, has anyone ever been given a list in the 10 years that AE has existed who
no,
abused
the list? No, that's not about TAP. That's not about
it
TAP.
It is about TAP, because
no,
that's well, their excuse for not giving out lists of petition signers to the TAP folks. Is they're worried it's going to be abused.
Richard, has anyone ever abused the list? No. Richard did not speak about TAP. He mentioned that TAP would be opening at the conference.
He mentioned TAP, so therefore it's reasonable for me to raise this.
David, I'm sorry. You have to ask a question about the conference if you want to be on.
I'm asking a question. I didn't ask to speak before TAP was mentioned. Now that TAP has been mentioned, you're being
point of order. Point of order.
Yeah. Who raised the point of order?
Craig. Richard's presentation was not about the details about TAP. It was just he mentioned that they were launching. His presentation is about the September 11th activities and the conference, and I don't think that this is on subject.
Can we have a vote?
I'm ruling in favor of the point of order. David, if you'd like to challenge, we can take a...
I'd like to challenge.
Okay, that's fine. The ruling of the chair has been challenged. All in favor of upholding the ruling of the chair, say aye.
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 All opposed, say no.
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 No. Okay, we'll have to take our roll call vote. I'm sorry. Craig, call the roll.
Okay, give me a second here to get my page back. Okay, Adam Ruff.
I'm sorry, I should clarify. A vote of yes is uphold the ruling of the chair. A vote of no is rescinding the ruling of the chair.
Adam Ruff, on my question.
What is
Adam
the
Ruff
of the
votes
chair,
yes.
I beg your pardon?
Could you please just state what the ruling of the chair is against
it? Yes, the ruling of the chair is that the question is out of order, that it's not pertaining to the subject matter of Richard's presentation.
And could you repeat the question?
The question is, has AE ever had an instance of trusted people being given a list of petition signers and then abusing that list, which is the rationale for not giving out lists of TAP people?
Thank you. That's clear. Okay. So that now we understand yes is saying that the question is off the subject of Richard's presentation, and no says it is in line with Richard's presentation and therefore in order. So, Craig, please call the roll.
Adam Ruff. Are you there, Adam?
Yes, to uphold the ruling by the chair.
Okay. Tim Michael.
Yes.
Dennis Cimino.
Yes.
John O'Malley.
There's John.
Star Texas is muted. He's passing. Okay.
Good Lord.
Okay. Did John? Did you?
He passed.
Give a vote.
He passed.
Okay. Okay. Roger Boris.
No.
Okay. Dan Hennen.
No.
Wayne Costi.
Yes.
Jerry Turner.
No.
Okay. Xander Arena.
Yes.
Martin Bruce.
Yes, however, I would say that the question should be asked at some other venue. It's a worthwhile question. Not here.
Barbara Honegger?
All right, I'll give you my answer. I would just like to know if Richard Gage would like to answer it. I think he should be able to answer it regardless. But I would say
that's not what we're voting on.
Procedure, Barbara.
It's a point of order. That's out of order, Barbara.
Well, there was someone else who gave a comment also.
Nobody else was trying to change what we're trying to do here right now. Just you. Okay, so please.
I wasn't.
Yes or no?
I simply made a comment. I would hope
that you
would answer regardless.
Well, that's your comment. What's your vote?
My vote is yes.
Dave Schlesinger, we know yours is no. So, Richard Gage?
Yes.
Sheila Casey?
No.
David Cole?
Pass.
Kat McGuire?
I don't want it to move forward.
I'm sorry?
If no, here we don't go forward with this proposal.
I'm not getting...
I don't think she's confused. If you vote yes, then the question is called out of order. If you vote no, the question is considered pertinent and it will be asked. Okay?
I'll vote yes.
And Anita Renfrew?
Yes.
Okay. Let me total this up. I think the yeses have it. My yes vote is also yes, by the way. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 yeses, 1, 2, 3, 4 noes, and 2 passes.
Okay.
So the chair's
ruling to hold. The question's out of order. Who else would like to be on the stick? Anybody else need to ask a question to make a comment here? I think we're out of time on this issue anyway. So, Richard, thanks so very much for rejoining the teleconference and bringing us up to date on this really most important event. Hopefully we'll get the details from your email and distribute it with the minutes so that everyone in the queue list will be apprised. Okay?
Thanks, Ken. Thanks, everybody. See you at New York.
Okay. So, we move right to our next question, which is actually normally would have been a first question on the list because it's basically, it's kind of an internal question. I talked with Cheryl Curtis, and she's expressed a limited interest, limited in the sense that she's not interested in doing this kind of on-call facilitation, but she is someone who has a very good connection, sets her own radio show, and is willing to help provide speakers for our teleconference, in which case that assistance being so valuable, I would recommend that we consider her for that offer. To be considered co-facilitator and named as such. And she's willing to do that for our ongoing teleconferences. So, would anybody like to second the motion?
Second.
Second.
Thank you. Any objection to Cheryl Curtis being named co-facilitator of the teleconference? Hearing none, I thank you, and I'll let Cheryl know that we'll consider her co-facilitator in the future and thank her for her efforts to provide interesting speakers. Okay. Thank you all. Moving on, our next topic is basically original feature for today. Wayne Kosky is going to give us a tutorial on full-scale aircraft crash impact tests and their relevance to 9/11. Wayne, The floor is yours.
Thank you so much, Ken. I was intrigued over the years by looking at the list of things that are topics associated with the teleconference at the bottom of this, and I saw that there was full-scale, there was a crash test was one of the topics. As I began noticing that there were, in fact, historical crash tests a few months ago, I was unaware of them other than the Sandia one. I decided that I would kind of look into them, and I found that there was some, that there was not just one, but there was quite a few of them. And that what I wanted to do was pull together a kind of a compilation of them and see what I could see about the issues that might be relevant to 9/11. There, of course, nothing is ever going to be quite right. And then we hear that Paul Salo. So let me just also tell you that I have put together a PowerPoint slide. It's in a PDF format, and there's a link to it in the agenda. I updated it Monday night to correct a link and to also add a short little section to it. I'm going to be mentioning slide numbers. Because of the format, not all the slides have numbers on them. So let's begin. So on slide two, we've got the table of contents. There's a 9/11 redo initiative. I'm going to touch on four plane crash tests, and there are the 1964 crash test of a DC-7. 1965 crash test of a Lockheed Constellation, an 84 crash test of a Boeing 720, and the 1988 crash test of a Phantom F4 that many of you probably know. So, slide four, again, this is because many people have suggested replicating the plane crashes on 9/11 or some portions of it. To determine whether destruction can be replicated, Can planes penetrate steel structures, for example, the Twin Towers, survivability of wings after hitting light posts. Crash tests, large full-scale crash tests are considered expensive and practical and possibly would not actually provide a resolution to the issues. Historical plane crash tests are informative in what they have found out from them and how and what could possibly go wrong. The 9/11 redo initiative may try to replicate some of the 9/11 events. Slide five is a partial list of some of the full-scale crash tests. These are ones in which the effect of splashing, enlisting fuel, how that would contribute to fires and damage, are listed here. So you can see there's quite a history of full-scale crash tests, and so I'm only going to touch on a couple of those. And I have links scattered throughout the PowerPoint to let you dig in deeper if you're interested. Slide seven is the beginning of the 9/11 redo announcement. Paul Salo wants to rent, or not rent, he wants to hire a team to fly a 747 or something like that into a steel frame building and see what the impacts would be. He launched this several months ago, and with the hopes of being able to accomplish some demonstration and see what can happen. Slide eight tells us that the goal is to really see what's going to happen. He's looking for $300,000 at a minimum, and other people have suggested he's looking for $1.5 million to faithfully recreate some of the events of 9/11 with a single test. Slide nine, he has launched an initiative on Indiegogo. It was taken down once it hit the press that he was doing this, and he's tried to move around to different funding sources, and apparently everywhere he's gone has been turned down. 510 is an update from about a month ago. I don't see anything much more recent than that about his activities. But he says banks and all the payment gateways are making it really difficult, and I think he's down to bitcoins, things like that. Well, that's the end of the 9/11 redo. And so slide 11 is the introduction to the 64 crash test of a DC-7. the DC crash test.
Excuse me, just a second. I'm sorry. Listen, somebody's running something in the background, making noise. Would everybody please just star six your phones, and that way there won't be any background. And then when you want to come back in, star six if you want to get in a discussion afterwards. Okay? Star six, please, everybody. Thank you.
It could have been my fan, the fan on my computer here. We'll see if it's quieter now. So the DC crash test objectives, as are most related to these full-scale crash tests, are occupant survivability, to document the plane damage upon impact, to look at things like what happens if you crash into trees. The DC-7 was a transport aircraft built and designed in the early 50s. Slide 13. DC-7 is about half the size of a Boeing 757. There's some dimensions here. I don't need to go through them. But it's about half the size and a much slower plane than a 757. 14. The key observations of this crash test related to 9/11 is that the wing impacts two wood telephone poles. The outer pole is 12 inches, and it severs the wing about 12 feet in where it impacts. The inner pole, which is 13 inches, was severed by the wing. And we'll see that. I'll be focusing in on that because I thought that was really fascinating that they actually had a video of this. The wing was crushed back about 3 feet to the leading spar when it fractured the pole. The wood pole is, of course, similar to the Pentagon tree in column 16 that was sheared off with the remnants of the shattered stuff remaining in the ground. Slide 15 is a slide of the fuel tank locations. This particular aircraft had a very large end-of-wing tank. Slide 16, the DC-7 is, again, much smaller. It destroyed the wood pole that was close in. The damage to the wing less than 0.2-inch thick aluminum streetlight poles would be much less than the wood pole. Again, I mentioned this the tree, column 16. So if we go on to slide 17, and there's probably about a dozen slides, there's a number on the top left with a timing. I don't know if what I'm recording and talking about here is actually full time, but on the video, these are about half-second steps from the video. And I'm just going to pace through them. So the front one is just showing the plane approaching, showing pole one and pole two. Front two, it begins to impact some of the stuff that they put in front of it to damage the engines. Slide three, it's just moving along. It's on a rail. It's not actually flying. So it's very carefully orchestrated for what it's going to hit. Slide four, front four, it's still coming. Still more debris is flying around as it's impacting stuff. Slide five, more of the same. Slide six, more of the same. Slide seven, front seven, it now impacts the pole one on the left-hand side. And you're going to see the wing is going to be sheared off at the end. Pole two has not yet hit. Front eight, the wing is now sliced through by the pole on the left. Pole two has not yet hit. You can see what the top of the pole is. And now you can see the top of the pole has been moved on slide nine, front nine. Front ten, the wing is actually flipped upside down. The wing end is flipped upside down because it's no longer connected, but still has forward momentum. Pole two is swinging back down because it's severed. Front 11 is just the next step. And then after that, we get to the image where we have the wing as a side view. And so what we're going to see here, again, it's about another dozen slides. I'm going to go through this mostly pretty quick. But the one that says wing initial is just showing the camera. As we go to wing 02, the designation in the top right-hand corner, you can see pole 1 coming. This is going to impact the outer wing. wing the wing three, you can see the shadow of the pole, but you can't see the pole because it's now kind of underneath. You can see the next one, wing four, you can still see pole one shadows are visible. Wing five, you start to see more dark stuff as the wing is sliced. Wing six, more things are starting to spray out. Wing seven, the next one, not much else has changed. Wing eight, I've marked out where the pole is. Wing nine, we're approaching the pole two. You can see the shadow in the foreground. Wing 10, the shadow is getting closer. Wing 11, now I've got some markings at the top here that shows in each of the quarter seconds where that pole should be. But it's not going to be there because in some of them, because it's going to have been pushed after being broken. So wing 11 is where we're at. Next one, wing 12, the pole is now about ready to impact the leading spar. It is now impacted. It's still upright. It's still where it moves as far as it's supposed to have. The next one, wing 13, you can see that it hasn't moved where it's supposed to, meaning that the bottom has been kicked out and pushed forward. And wing 14, you can see that the pole has been shattered and is tipping. Wing 15, the same. It's all being destroyed. Wing 16, you can see more of this, kind of more of the same. Wing 17, some of the pieces are still there, but the wing is still attached. And wing 18, more of the shadow. Now, that was probably the most dramatic set of photos. I thought they were pretty fascinating. The next section is on slide 46. It's a 1965 Lockheed Constellation. It's really very similar, so there's really, it doesn't have as much detail. So I'm just going to be going through this one rather quickly. Slide 47, the Lockheed Constellation is about three quarters the size of a Boeing 757. The dimensions are, the statistics are on slide 47 for you to look at. Slide 48 talks about the observation. The right wing impacted the telephone poles. They nearly shattered the outer wing panel, the outer one, and the inboard one remained attached to the fuselage. The number three engine remained attached to the fuselage throughout the crash. Again, there's documentation of the crash test at the link below. Key observations for slide 49 is that a plane impacting something as massive as wood poles, a 12-inch tree, can shatter them, similar to the 1964 DC-7 crash test. Both reports were published in 1965. They're companion reports, effectively, and so it's a little confusing as to what year they are. I've referred to this one as 64, so that's when it actually occurred. The Lockheed tanks are shown on the slide 60, where the fuel tanks are. Again, what they would have done is put different liquids in there just so that they could study where that liquid went. And this shows where the poles went through the when the plane passed by them. The next slide is slide 51. These are, again, half-second sets, and I'm just going to go through them. There's really nothing much of great merit to these, except they're yet another example of a plane severing wood poles. So the one called at 00 is the beginning. At the one at 50, half-second steps, it's 51. It gets closer, impacts. At 1.0, it impacts the outer one, starts to shear off the pole. Pole hasn't moved. In 149, it has moved, hasn't yet impacted the closer in pole. At 2 seconds, it has just begun. At 2.51 seconds, you can see, and beyond, you can see that the pole is starting to, has been crushed and is falling down. And I'm just going to skip through those. Just for reference, because we talked about the location of fuel tanks, the Boeing has surge tanks that are at either end. They're about 11 feet into the wing from the wingtip, just to get a better sense as to where the fuel tanks are. Going on to slide 65, the 1984 crash test, that's a Boeing 720. It was remotely controlled. Slide 66, it was remotely controlled into a barren patch of desert. And the whole purpose, again, was to look at the anti-misting fuels to see what the impacts would be. This showed how difficult it is to do a remote-controlled, at least with the technology that was available in 1984. In slide 67, again, it was designed to, this tells you what the purposes were, improve crash protection and reduce post-crash fire hazards were the main impetus for it. The slide 68 has some crash objectives. All these things are highly instrumented, and I don't think I need to say any more about this. Slide 69, the key observations for 9/11. Again, the plane approached the ground at a shallow, the ground at a shallow angle, very much like the large plane that is, people saw at the Pentagon. So it's approaching the ground at a shallow angle. The ground effect did not prevent the plane from approaching the ground. Wing flaps were down, which increases the ground effect. The slower speed increases the ground effect. The plane descended smoothly below its half wing length that some people say is really important, and it slid on the underside of the plane upon hitting the ground. Moving on to slide 70, it's the beginning of the images. This shows the shallow angle approach above a flat ground surface. These don't have any specific markings on them, so I'll just go to slide 71. It shows that the plane altitude is now about a half wingspan above the flat surface. The next slide says the plane is less than half wingspan above the flat surface. The next one shows talks a little bit about ground effect. It does not push the port wing up to the level to level the plane up. The ground effect were a strong force that becomes exponentially greater with as the wing approaches the ground. As some suggest, the port wing should not be able to drop closer to the ground than the starboard wing without a large force from the control surfaces. And what I've done is I've tried to draw some of the vectors in, saying that if they were so much stronger on the port wing, the plane should have been forced up, but it is not. And you can see how this, you can see it in the video if you go to the link. The next slide, the wing, very far end of the wing touches the ground. The ground effect obviously didn't keep the plane level. The next slide, you're starting to see damage to the wing and kicking up of a lot of dust. The next slide shows that the ground effect, my comment is the ground effect cushion of air does not prevent shallow angle impact above a flat ground surface. So that's most of what I wanted to show. But I also did a few days ago, got into a discussion about the yaw motion as a result of a plane impacting with unequal forces. And so I did I looked at what happened if you looked at the tail of this plane, how much would it rotate? This may or may not be relevant. There are some things that I think are important about it. I can talk about that later, but I'll just scan through this pretty quickly. It's a series of pictures, and if you go to slide, the first one, you'll know that I put a little red mark on the tail, and a number one.
Let me let you know you're at 18 minutes, okay?
Okay, I'm doing okay.
Well, you want to leave a little time for questions and answers, all right? Okay.
So, thanks, Ken. So, so this is the slide has the number one on it with a red marking for the where the tail is located. The next one is just showing where it is on slide two. A little bit later,
slide, the one with the marking 3 is just a little bit later, slide 4. You can just scan through until we get to slide 7, or the marking. And then the last one just basically shows that just how much a free body can rotate with a relatively minor impact on one side of the wing. If you go from points of 4 to 6, what you see is that there's a significant rotation visible on the plane. And in this case here, the engine on the opposite side was not at full power. When you get to point 7, it's almost sideways, but the plane's also moving to the left, so it's not as useful. And that's what I wanted to show on that. Now I want to move on to the 1988 Phantom F4. Most of you have seen this one. This is slide 86. The test parameters were that the Phantom F4 was intended to impact a concrete block. The Phantom is 19 tons. It's had a 480 mile an hour impact speed. The block is reinforced concrete, 23 square feet and 12 foot thick. Total mass of almost 500 tons. It's placed on air bearings to allow the block to accelerate upon impact with the exchange of momentum. Slide 88. The results were that when it was crashed into the concrete block, there were no weak spots, and so the block remained solid. The penetration depth was less than 2.25 inches for the engine itself, and the block moved about a foot during the impact time period, and then it continued to slide further. You'll see that in the images. Slide 89 is looking at the Pentagon wall. I want to get a feel for the different mass here. The Pentagon wall had 24% open space, which is where the glass was. Slide 90 is some calculations where I come up with an approximate estimate of the 80 feet of opening on the first floor being about 96 tons of wall material, which is about one-fifth the Sandia block, just so we can just to see what the transfer momentum might look like. Slide 91, Kia observations related to 9/11. I think they're actually really limited with this particular case because you had an F4 with 17% of the mass at a speed that was comparable to a large plane impact, but it hit a solid concrete block, 5 times more massive, so it's like a lightweight hitting someone on the defensive team of the Seattle Seahawks. There was confetti-like debris from the F4 impact. The solid concrete block required that all debris got reflected back. And the Pentagon wall, if it broke as it appears, the plane mass would have entered the building and not so much mass would have been reflected back. Slide 92. Actually, I think this is kind of redundant. I will skip slide 92 and proceed to slide 93. One of the most interesting things that I found in looking at this was the momentum airflow in the wake of the aircraft. Cameras were set up in many different angles, not just the one that we typically have seen, and the momentum of the air mass impacting the wall, creating upward and outward dispersion of debris is in all directions is clearly visible. It illustrates the reasons for a Pentagon fireball and northward distribution of the debris towards the heliport. That's because the airflow behind the plane impacts the wall area, can't go through it, and so it goes upward and outward and creates the fireball. And you can see the similar impacts or similar effects in these examples here. So moving on to the images, this is the first one, slide 94, has the initial block location. I show 1 foot markings. Moving through these quickly, slide 95 just shows the F4 beginning to impact. Slide 96, it's starting to impact. Momentum hasn't yet been accelerated the large block. Slide 97, you can see that most of the momentum has now been transferred. There's not much left on slide 97. By slide 98, you can see that the block is has pushed forward about one of those markings, about 1 foot. And slide 99 is moved almost fully a foot. Now, what I want you to observe is the debris from this is being scattered in all different directions, upward and outward, and that is because of the airflow behind the plane rushing in and doing the dispersal. Had this impacted a solid concrete block in space, it would have just crunched up on it with very little reflected back, and it certainly would not have had the upward and outward direction. Slide 100 shows one of the most fascinating images of this, and it shows that the trailing air mass had come in and is, in fact, I've illustrated the physics of it because you can't see the air, but it's coming in at on the order of 480 miles an hour in the rear end, and it is hitting the wall and going off in all directions. So I thought that was one of the most interesting videos, and the link there so you can see it in more detail if you want. I'll take questions now. I've gone through an amazing number of slides. Hope I didn't lose you all. So I'll take questions.
Okay, one moment. Okay, thank you, Wayne. Before we go to the questions, are Jim Fester and Dennis Camino on the call?
I'm here, Dennis Camino. I'm here.
Dennis, you're here. Is Jim Fester here? *6 if you muted, Jim. *6.
Okay. Also, I need to ask who joined the call recently that hadn't been part of the call before. We have somebody that joined a half an hour ago or so. Who was that?
Hey, Mike Cook here.
Mike Cook, okay. And who joined more recently?
Well, I'm how's recently?
Roger.
I mean,
Roger. Who?
Roger.
Yeah, I know Roger. You rejoined. Who joined the call that wasn't part of the call before?
It wasn't a half hour. It was just like 10 minutes maybe.
Okay. Well, who joined the call a half an hour ago? Well, I guess that's a missed call. I'm not sure. Okay, so all right, so we'll take questions and comments on Dwayne's presentation. Who would like to be on the stand?
Barbara,
who else?
Xander?
I'd like to also ask questions, but let Barbara go ahead.
I'm sorry, Barbara, Xander, who else? Who else? Barbara, Xander? Okay, I thought somebody else was talking to you. All right, we only have a few minutes, a couple of minutes actually. So, Barbara, please keep it brief, and Xander too. Go ahead, Barbara.
Okay, what I'll probably do after the call in the next day or so is make a list of these, because I probably won't be able to get all of my comments. But one of the main ones is the presentation seems to me to try to have it both ways. The whole point of the presentation is more or less to support the story of the Pentagon. And you can't use the F4 tests, especially the last of the four crash tests. If you notice that this plane, this F4, only got about the penetration of these massive engines relative to the fuselage of the F4 only got 2.5 inches into the wall. And there was confetti-like debris that was going off in all directions that you can see. So you either have it one way or the other at the Pentagon. You don't penetrate into the Pentagon and have all of this reflected confetti-like debris.
So was that your question?
It's a comment. I mean,
let me just respond since we don't have a lot of time.
Yeah.
First, you do know that I did put in the presentation that the dimensions for the penetration of the engine being 2.5 inches into a solid concrete block. Remember, this is a solid concrete block. It's not a Pentagon, not the Pentagon wall that is made up of 6 inches of limestone, 8 inches of bricks, and 12 inches of concrete with 24% window space supported only by reinforcements behind the thicker flash-resistant glass.
It's a total of 2 feet, though.
It's a total of 2 feet, most of which is crumbly stuff, the bricks and the limestone. The concrete wall is only 12 inches thick. The Sandia block was 10 feet thick.
It was also specifically hardened to withstand precisely such a terrorist attack.
The plane also hit not straight on. I don't want to get into this piece of it. I would like to talk about the plane crash test with Xander next. But the impact that on the Pentagon wall was not straight on. It was sideways in a direction that a truck bomb would not be exerting those kinds of forces. Potentially that was the plan. I don't know. But again, the Pentagon wall is no more than a 2 feet thick, half of which is crumbly, bricks mortared together, and some concrete with very large holes. 24% of that floor space, that wall space, is open. So I'd like to have Xander give the next question, and if we can come back to you, Barbara, because we're running out of time.
I'll give my rebuttal in an email. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Barbara. Xander?
I wanted to comment that the statement about the composition of that section of the Pentagon leaves out the Kevlar jacketing that was added during the renovation. It's visible in photographs.
Exactly. Yes.
And that significantly hardens the outside of the Pentagon. And then in addition to that, I'd also like to state that there's no evidence of wing entry slots to go all the way into the building and no engine penetration points either. And you couldn't get so lucky as to have engines fly through windows here. I mean, you could possibly with one by statistical numbers, but we know exactly where the hole is, which has a structural member hanging down right in the center of it. It would have been swept clean out of the hole if an airliner would have gone through there. But I wanted to reinforce what Barbara said, and I concur with her statement too. So I'm going to step back here and let other people make their comments.
Well, Xander, I have to ask for a clarification. When you say that there was a pole right in the middle, you're talking about the small hole on the second floor, not the 80-foot clear stand-to-stand opening on the first floor. Is that right? You're talking about the hole on the second floor?
There's no 80-foot hole in the opening of the building.
That is correct. There's no 80-foot hole, at most 50 feet.
Well, I'll just simply say, you got to look at the pictures. The column is hanging down. It's column 16 is clearly shattered. The thing that looks like the bottom is the shattered tree stump. I went through that in my January 27th PowerPoint. If you don't have it, I'll be glad to send it to you again. There is an 80-foot hole, it's there.
I disagree. It's not there.
Okay.
Unfortunately, we don't. Yeah. Thank you. We don't have time for the debate, unfortunately, because it would be a very excellent debate. But since that exhausts our stack and exhausts our time, I want to thank Wayne for the incredible effort that he put into preparing this. And we need to move on to our next topic now. In the interest of time, it's over. That's great.
I didn't get to ask that question. I just wanted to make that comment. That wasn't me asking the question, so that's fine.
Well, wait a minute. That was you. That was you that was just making that comment, wasn't it?
No, it was not.
It was not. Who was the previous speaker?
I think what Xander says is he made a comment. He didn't get around to asking the question.
I didn't make a comment. My line dropped, and I called back into the call.
I heard him call back in. So who was it? Who was it that made that comment, please, for the record? Who was it that was just talking with Wayne, if it wasn't Xander?
It was Xander.
No, it wasn't Xander. He dropped.
No, it wasn't. My comment has to do with the ground effect and the fact that the plane in the example may have potentially had control turning it to the left, thereby preventing the ground effect. We don't know that. It's a variable that you don't know from your example. That's my only comment.
So I need a clarification. We're talking about the 1984 Boeing 720 that crashed, and that's the one we were talking about, right?
Correct.
Right. And so it was being flown by remote control, but you can look at the video from several different angles. If you go click on it, and what you'll see is that the plane is basically, you know, it's got some momentum, turning to the port side, so it is on the downward. But if there is a significant amount of ground effect, and it's as strong as some people assert, it should be so much greater that it would counteract the control surfaces on the tail, the rudders, and you can actually in the video you can see the any deflection of the control surfaces. And I welcome your rebuttal presentation with this as an example. So with that.
Okay, Wayne. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you again, Wayne, for this effort. And it's time now we can move on to...
Point of clarification, who was the speaker before this last speaker if it wasn't Xander? Who was it? Who made the comment?
Xander, were you involved with the previous conference dialogue and then you dropped off and then you came back on? Is that what happened?
Negative. I had no input whatsoever regarding the entry hole in the building or any of that.
But you had talked about the reinforcement of the wall and so forth, right?
Correct. I didn't know. None of that was me.
So that was you, and then you dropped off and you came back. Okay, thank you.
No, I said it was. I said it was not me. Not me. Negative.
Well, we do
it's Samino. It's Samino doing that.
That's Samino. Okay.
The only thing I rebutted was the
size. It was Dennis Samino. Dennis.
Oh, Dennis. Okay, Dennis.
Okay. We got it. It was Dennis Domino talking while you had dropped off the call, so now we know. Okay, so now we need to move on, and it is time for Dennis Domino and Jim Fester, if he's on the call yet, to make their presentation on some comments or some of the assertions in Smoke Curtain. Dennis, I guess you might have to wing it yourself because I don't think Jim is here.
Yeah, not a problem. The thing is, that I'd like to say is that when you examine, you know, all the photography that we have, which has been out there for quite a while about the Pentagon, there's a huge amount of wreckage that is completely missing in the general area around the impact point. And we're talking about a fence between the lawn and the rest of the building that was erected, probably to keep people from getting too close to the building during the construction phase when they renovated it. But there would have been significant amounts of aircraft wreckage trapped between that chain link fence and the wall if that airplane didn't get there. And yet there wasn't.
Excuse me, could somebody stop breathing heavily into the phone? I'm having trouble hearing him.
Star 6, everybody, if you're not the person giving the presentation, please, star 6.
And Dennis, if you could speak up, you're very soft and hard to hear.
Okay, the other thing I wanted to make clear is that the entry hole is way too small for a penetration, and I got to beg to differ with the 80-foot circumference or whatever you want to say it. It's a much smaller hole. It's not even the approximate size of the aircraft fuselage, even, and there's a major structural member of the building, concrete and rebar, hanging down about one-third of the way into the hole from the top of it, which would have been completely cleanly swept out of the hole with the 465-knot airplane hitting it that weighs 100 tons. So I'm not really clear on how you can justify why there's still...
Excuse me, Dennis, I may not have made myself clear, but you are now on for the presentation that Jim requested regarding Barbara's smoke curtain assertions, not about the last thing, okay?
Okay, so anyway, I don't really have a major problem with much of what Barbara has said, but I do have a little bit of an issue with the... with a replica aircraft having struck the building. Now, you know, given what it is, a replica aircraft that would have appeared to be approximately the same size, albeit it could have been made of fiberglass, it would have taken an awful lot of work to build a 767 replica out of fiberglass, and it would have been
moderately heavy, probably even heavier than aluminum airline, even going down to it, which is another point I wanted to make. We don't see anything but tiny white fiberglass shards visible in the helipad area. And when I talked to Barbara a number of years ago in 2012, when we first met in Vancouver, she and I had a pretty lengthy discussion, and amicably so. So we kind of came to the conclusion that the white pieces were probably from a lesser than a non-aluminum airplane, or air vehicle, to be more specific, and that was present all over the helipad area, considerably to the left, probably what I'd have to say to the north, as an impact hole, and there wasn't much, there was no signs of significant amounts of this debris, more than maybe 10 or 15 feet outward from the wall. And early photographs that were presented by a number of fairly decent sources that showed the actual lawn and the impact area within 8 minutes of the missile impact or whatever struck it. I asserted the missile, but you can beg to differ. 8 minutes later, there was a complete dearth of aircraft debris, with the exception of the small parts that couldn't really be seen very clearly, because many of the photographs that we have initially in the first 8 minutes are taken from the distance far enough away to where the smaller pieces that you have to get closer in to see them are visible, but it looks like snow. It doesn't look like you can't really discern individual chunks of it, and they took some measures to pick up these pieces and put them in buckets. So some other points I'd like to make is that we have no engine penetration points. We have no wing penetration points in the building where they would have completely penetrated the building to completely disappear, or else they would have been outside. It can't be either or. It's going to be one or the other. So where do we have the lion's share of the main spar assemblies and the significant portion of the wing outside? Not there. As a matter of fact, I would have expected, had this been a 757, the light poles, there would have been leading edge flats found probably before the building, pieces of wing structure would have landed on the ground, and therefore there would have been probably some aircraft wing components before the main aircraft struck. We know that the engines are predictably so many feet from each other. I believe it's 48 feet centerline to centerline on the engine of a 757-200. We don't see penetration points where those engines would have penetrated. I believe that the Kevlar jacket, which everybody is glossing over, doesn't seem to really want to admit that it was there, it was added during the renovation. The Kevlar jacketing probably would have made it very hard, even for the 7-ton RB211 to penetrate the building. It probably would have been massive dents at the bare minimum, and we would have probably seen significant portions of the engine still outside. They were added to photographs that came out many months later. The stacked engine in front of the generator trailer, which is clearly visible in the early photographs, where no engine existed. So that wreckage showed up much later. Later on, photographs showed wreckage in parts of the lawn that were bereft of wreckage. We've already established, for the most part, that this wreckage came from a Buga Columbia crash that occurred in December of 1995. The aircraft was recovered by an Israeli recovery team, and they were prosecuted in the state of Washington, where I live, by a U.S. attorney that was murdered during the conduct of his investigation into the procurement and the resale of the components from the crash. So there's a lot of issues with this wreckage. So it appears that some of it appeared several minutes later to be placed on the Pentagon lawn. We have photographs of FBI agents strewing wreckage around and moving it from the building out to the lawn. In more than one occasion, that we've got these in stuff that we published. We have no evidence of any jet fuel on the lawn of any kind. In a case like this, where at least 5,300 gallons of Jet A were alleged to have been on the plane at the time of impact, much of the facade of the Pentagon would have been oily and coated with it, even though there was allegedly a fireball, which I contend is predominantly fake and artificial and not reality.
So we don't have any evidence of the fuel. We don't have any parts of the aircraft. We have no miles and miles of wiring evidence in the entry hole. We don't have seat backs and cushions and tray tables and overhead bins. We don't have body parts outside the Pentagon. We have many, many clues that say that, that a 100-ton airplane is absent at the Pentagon, and the dirt, the wreckage there, doesn't support a total impact of a 757 under any circumstances. And then you can't take this one step further, as some people like Mike Rivero and other people would like to make it, you know, Wayne Gates, for instance, like to make you believe that the airplane could demolecularize and turn into basic atomic particles from a 465-knot impact, which, again, is preposterous. The aircraft couldn't have attained that speed down that low because of the restrictions on due to the parasites and drag components on an aircraft of that size. So we've got many, many problems here. But fundamentally, the hole is too small. There's no entry point for the wings or for the engines. And it's preposterous to go in the direction of saying that if the wings folded back like a barn swallow that went into the hole, or the wings completely disintegrated into subatomic particles, at least I would have expected significant components of the wings, parts of the empennage, horizontal and vertical stabilizers. Both engines predominantly have been probably evident in pieces around the front of the building, so heavily reinforced with Kevlar. If you want to contend this, take real good close looks at it. You can see the Kevlar jacket underneath the limestone that they added during the renovation part. So we also have a witness named April Gallup who came through the hole, the entry point, allegedly, and found no airplane parts, no wreckage, no blood, no wiring, no components of any aircraft, and certainly her feet are completely dry. Laying on the soap stretcher when this guy was laying out on the lawn, which means that she couldn't have possibly gone through any fuel, which would have been copiously there in the event of an airplane crash, even with the fireball. So you've got many, many things that say no airplane impact. And, I didn't come on here to cross swords with Barbara, but I'm having a little bit of a difficult time understanding a replica aircraft looking like it. I do think it's... color scheme that she imparts, which is totally possible, by the way, only reinforcing what she says, could have been from a C-32 transport, a VIP transport, a military and the government operates, which is a Boeing 757, meaning that it didn't necessarily have to match the American Airlines color scheme in any way, make or form, to get people to believe what they were seeing approaching the building with an airliner full of passengers. If we can believe any of the eyewitness accounts that she does put forth, and I'd like to lend credence to them, if we believe any of that, then it seems to indicate that a 757 in the C-32 configuration, government transportation configuration, probably did the overflight. By no means did it impact the building, because we're missing 100 tons of airplane. We're missing penetration points. We're missing a dearth of wreckage that would have been present. And furthermore, we have tons of evidence showing that they moved wreckage from one place to the other, and photographed it in multiple positions, which, I'm sorry, I can't believe that you're going to find the piece that was found outside the entry hole, and then again by the C-ring exit hole. That's not possible. It's the same exact part. We've identified it positively. There's evidence of FBI teams moving wreckage around. And whether you believe that O'Brien's aircraft seeded the location of the wreckage or not, the small amount of wreckage present on the lawn didn't even comprise one ton of airplane parts. And then we have interior photographs that don't really show aircraft structures of any kind. So my point being is that I can't substantiate in any way, make or form, any of these allegations that an airplane penetrated this building. Particularly a Boeing 757 with 5,300 gallons of Jet A on it. It's preposterous, and it doesn't compute. I've seen many, many aircraft wrecks. I'm not I'm a vibrations and shock systems engineer, as well as my other EMI and EMT training. It goes back 35 to 40 years, all the way through my whole entire career. So I'm pretty up to speed with mass transfer stuff and things. I can't tell you precisely what the transfer would be without having specific numbers from the aircraft knowing precisely all the material that was on the station building. So I can tell you that an airplane didn't hit the building at 465 knots and disintegrate. That's ludicrous. So
thank you. Thank you very much.
Hey. So that's about all I have to really state here. And I'd like anybody else to rebut that with anything that they think is solid enough to rebut it.
Okay. Well, let me say first, I appreciate all the information that you've provided. Unfortunately, it really didn't pertain very much to the topics that Jim requested the time for, but it was all very interesting anyway. Who would like to be on the stack to
make
a comment?
Wayne here.
Barbara.
Craig.
Craig. Well, okay. Try to keep the comments to about a minute, okay, Barbara?
Yeah, well, I just want to be clear to everybody that Dennis's comments did address the question. It's just that Jim Setzer completely misrepresents my position in Smoke Curtain, and Dennis Cimino and I effectively agree on almost everything. We agree that a 757 did not hit at the official story impact point. We agree it is not an 80-foot point opening. We agree that there is debris around the heliport, quite a bit of it, that it's like confetti. We agree that the F-4 crash test produced confetti-like debris. We agree that it was white fiberglass. We agree that it was some kind of a mocked-up vehicle. The one thing, Dennis, that you don't understand yet, or you've gotten incorrect misinterpretation in Smoke Curtain, I do not claim, nor do I believe, that a plane, the plane that got disintegrated or exploded or imploded near the heliport hit the wall at all. It was somehow destroyed after its left wing, having been seen by multiple witnesses, having first hit close or on the helipad. So it didn't actually hit the wall. There's no evidence that it hit the wall. But some air vehicle that was mistaken as a 757 American Airlines plane because it was mocked up and it was made of fiberglass, like Dennis says, we agree on that. The inside coating wasn't anything like a real 757. So Dennis and I agree, and it's Jim Setzer who's misrepresenting my position in Smoke Curtain. Thank you.
Okay, Wayne, you're next.
Nothing to add.
Yeah, okay.
I'm online.
Thank you.
Okay, so Dennis, Mike, you've been doing this for quite some time, and so I assume that you've had the opportunity to review a lot of the evidence, the photos, and I find it astonishing that you can say that there's no entry point for the wings or the engine, especially the engine, because of the large openings. Whether you agree that the thing at column 16 is a complete column or shattered, or you can see that it's a tree stump in front that gives you the illusion of a complete thing, there is at least there's at least 80 feet of space that is open on the first floor. Are you saying that there is not 80 feet opening, an 80-foot opening on the bottom floor? And I'll give you the fact that the column 16 could be possibly separate dividing those, but 80 feet. Is there 80 feet of wall missing? Answer that, please.
I'm telling you that immediately after the impact, there's no evidence that an 80-foot hole existed. It wasn't even the size of the fuselage. For goodness sakes, it's a certain an 80-foot hole was left after the impact of a Boeing 757. I couldn't imagine a Boeing 757 making an 80-foot hole.
So, this is my conclusion. I want to be absolutely clear. You're not talking about what happened on the second floor, which is about a 16 or 18-foot opening. You're not talking about that. You're talking about the 80-foot or the large opening on the first floor. You're saying it doesn't exist, right?
I'm saying that there's only one entry hole. There's not multiple entry holes, and they don't transmit several floors. There's one hole that's barely, it's not even three-quarters the size of an aircraft fuselage of a 757 impact. I mean, you'd expect at least the size of the airplane fuselage if it penetrated the building, and that hole It's evident in all the photography I've seen. And I've studied these pictures for 15 years now since the event. I can't find any evidence of an 80-foot hole. I can tell you what happened after the collapse. Now we have a big, huge opening here where the building collapsed. But that is not the same as the damage immediately after the alleged aircraft impact. And I beg to differ.
Thank you very much.
And by the way, this is Barbara. The opening on the second floor is not 16 feet. There's vertical column 14 still in place with only less than 10 feet on either side.
Okay. We're almost out of time here, and Craig hasn't had a chance to speak. Craig, you want to make a quick comment?
Yeah, I'll be very quick because I just have a quick question for Dennis. You mentioned about evidence of fiberglass debris. And I gather you were referring to up near the heliport in that area. I'm unclear on what the proof is that the material that we do see sort of sprinkled around that area is fiberglass. How do we know that?
Well, the only real evidence to really prove that it is there's a fragment that most of you probably have never seen the film that was released by the U.S. federal government, by the way, that was provided to John Farmer, also known as Blue Collar Republican. He's done a lawsuit against the U.S. federal government about 9/11, but then switched sides. He was provided with a film showing a piece of debris being flung back by what appears to be a pole between the shared Doubletree and the building itself, and it lands in the parking lot in front of the security guard. He picks it up, looks at it briefly, and throws it. Ultimately, that piece of fiberglass wreckage lands inside of Peggy Algas's vehicle through the sunroof. She believes that it's a Boeing 757 component. I positively identified that piece as part of the leading edge of a Global Hawk RQ-4A remotely piloted vehicle. That's what that piece is, from the port's leading edge. And during part of the presentation I recently published with Kim Fessler, I actually stipulate the exact location of where that piece was on the wing, where it came from. And that is fiberglass, and it is composite, and it's completely commensurate with the type of material the RQ-4A is constructed as. So we do have evidence of at least one fiberglass piece that doesn't come from Boeing 757, having been flung back by something, probably a hole, on the pole strike and landing at the Sheraton Doubletree and being tossed into Peggy Algas's car. That's not a Boeing 757 wing port. That's not
right, and the interior of that piece is also dark red.
Right,
that's all part of the layup of this type of a vehicle. I'm very intimately familiar with these types of vehicles. I work at White Sands.
Right. One thing I'm still a little unclear on how Peggy Algas could think that if there was time for this person to pick up this piece and hurl it into her car, how could she be under the impression that it came from the original crash? Or I certainly have never heard that she believes somebody threw it into her car.
Well, she had no idea that it was thrown, but we have a piece of video that shows it actually being picked up and hurled by the security guard. And that's how it ended up in his car. Now, I can't prove that piece from his hand, as he flings it upwards, had a trajectory that took it directly into her car where it was parked. But guess what? How else did it get there? Was it planted? Yeah, possibly so. I mean, we cannot go down the road of saying that's out of the question. It's not out of the question. But
Dennis, can you provide us with that video clip?
I think I have it in my archives, but the thing is, it should be out there. And if it's, I know that if you could get a hold of John Farmer, I'm sure he would be amenable to providing it to you. Doesn't matter what side of the fence he's on now, but Robin Horton also should have this. And I know that you've maintained good contact with Robin. I just saw Robin about 9 months ago at a gas station locally here, and I think if Robin has it, we'd be happy to show it to you. But it's of a security camera showing this piece flying from the Pentagon, from the vicinity of the Pentagon, curling through space, lands in the parking lot, right in front of the security guard. He walks up to it, picks it up, briefly examines it for about a half a second, and then he flings it. And guess where I believe it landed? It went right through the sunroof and landed in her car. She didn't find it until after she got home. That piece is such a critical piece to prove that an RQ-4A Global Hawk vehicle struck the Pentagon. I can't tell you. And I believe it's, it was going sideways when it impacted. And the sound that we mentioned in the presentation that we recently made of a naval officer who was, happened to be present, he heard a loud clap, like swap, you know, like you clap your hands. That's approximately what the sound of something like that would make because of the composite construction of it.
Dennis, we do want to thank you for sharing all of this with us and hope that you'll come back another, you know, in the near future for another teleconference where we have more time, and let us know when you'd like to make a presentation on just a related subject, okay? Or just come back as a guest anytime, of course, and be part of our conversation, okay?
I want to thank everybody that's present today for the opportunity to talk about it.
Okay.
May I just say, Dennis, we'd like to be able to ask we'd like to be able to ask Robin Horden, but he's been removed from this teleconference. So if you could forward the video clip, it would be wonderful.
Or a link to it. Yeah, if you could forward a link, it'd be helpful.
Yeah, so it's an amazing piece of video, and like I said, Farmer provided a significant amount of information to us. The video was one of it. I think for the most part, it was more than one CD-ROM worth of stuff that we got from the government. And significant information, and like I said, I have to believe it's authentic because it does not look fake. It does appear to be authentic.
Okay, well, we'll look forward to if you get that link. Get out. We have to move on now to our last item on the agenda, which is revisiting our sadly derailed third debate, see what we're going to do about that. So there's two parts to this. Barbara wants to make a proposal, and Craig would like to review what happened in this last debate. So, Barbara?
Right. I'm going to give the reason first that I'm going to make a motion before I'm done speaking that the third debate with only Craig, if he's willing, be on the simple proposition that no plane was destroyed at the Pentagon, with Craig taking affirmative and me taking negative. I simply cannot support the proposal for the proposition a couple of times ago, simply because I don't believe it. I don't believe the evidence supports it. I do not take the position that a large plane was destroyed at the Pentagon. I take the position that a plane that was mistaken to be a 757 was destroyed before it would have otherwise hit the wall near the heliport. So I can't be railroaded into supporting a proposition I don't even believe. So I should just say that is the proposition I'm willing to debate, because it's the only proposition that can really distinguish between the two positions that Craig holds and that I hold. He holds that no plane was destroyed at the Pentagon. I claim that there was one, just not the plane that the government claims, nor where or when the government claims, but he claims no plane. So the only proposition that makes any sense for us to have a meaningful debate on that can move this discussion forward is the proposition no plane was destroyed at the Pentagon, with me taking the negative and Craig the positive. So it is my proposition, call for a second to the proposition for next debate being no plane was destroyed at the Pentagon. Do I hear a second?
I second.
I'll have to chime in on that. No commercial aircraft is destroyed at the Pentagon.
I can't hear
you. That would be a move to amend. Because right now, Barbara has requested this particular title, no plane. Okay. So
the reason is Craig believes no plane was destroyed at all. Excuse me, Barbara.
If you want to make a motion to amend, you may do that. You may move to amend her proposal
to reflect your own preference. That's what you may do if you don't like her title, okay? So that would be a possibility.
We have a second on my proposed title.
We have it. It's been moved and seconded, but I think Dennis said something about wanting to amend it, so I want to clarify. Are you moving to amend it?
For simplicity's sake, let's just call it airplane and leave it at that and say no airplane.
Okay. All right. So it's been moved and seconded that the date be scheduled with the title "No Plane Has Destroyed the Pentagon." Is there any objection to the proposal?
Craig?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, before I get into the other part, which is my explanation of the events that happened, I have to point out that we have an agreement in place that has been approved by all parties, including Barbara and including the majority of those on the teleconference when the vote took place. So before any new debate is approved, we have to know that Barbara is withdrawing from the agreement that we already have. So once she tells us, confirms to us that she's doing that, then, then we can look at a new agreement.
Well, I've already made it clear in an email that I absolutely do not agree with the proposal from the last time. No large plane was destroyed at the Pentagon.
Well,
I am willing to debate the only proposition that makes a difference between us, and that is that no plane was destroyed at the Pentagon.
Yes,
that's what I'm willing to debate. And may I go on record that you, Craig, did not debate what you had agreed to debate.
Barbara, point of order.
Craig has the floor.
Did you
we are not having that conversation again if I have anything to say about it, Barbara.
I am.
The point on the floor right now is that Craig has asked you to clarify whether you withdraw from the original agreement. And you're saying
that
can
happen.
Did that answer your question, Craig?
Well, it appears from that last comment that it has answered my question. It wasn't the case a minute or two ago. But, okay, so she's withdrawn from the agreement. Okay. I would suggest,
like
I would make a
proposal
that... You withdrew
from the original agreement for the second debate.
No.
Yes, you did. You did
point
not
of order
debate again. Proposal.
That's out of order, Barbara. We're talking about this debate now. We're talking about the third debate, okay? Now Craig... You just wanted to get that clarification, and that was it, right? You're done, right?
No, I had some. No, I was attempting to say something else when Barbara changed the subject.
All right.
Because I do have an explanation to give, I would propose that it would make sense for us to postpone the vote until after I have done that on what we're going to do to go forward.
Okay.
So I would suggest that I give my side of it, and then we go back to the vote.
As I understand that this is a motion to postpone consideration of this question until we take up part two of this conversation as scheduled, and then to return to this question. Is there a second to the motion?
I second the motion.
Okay, the motion has been made and seconded to postpone consideration of this question until we did the review of the what's happened in the last debate, the previous arrangement. Is there any objection to postponing it?
Yes, I object.
Okay, Barbara objects. So I guess we'll need to take a vote on it, unless anybody needs to clarify a position about it. Let's go ahead and say all in favor of moving this until after we have a chance to review the what happened on the previous agreement. Say aye.
Aye.
Oh, I'm sorry, everybody. If you're muted, you need to unmute by *6. And almost everybody, several people are muted. *6 to unmute, so that your voice can be heard either way on this vote. *6. Okay. All in favor of moving consideration of this question until after a review of the previous issues, say aye.
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 Aye. All opposed, say nay.
Nay.
Okay, I believe the ayes have it, so we'll move into the second portion immediately, and that would be Craig's review of what happened with this last race. So go ahead, Craig.
Okay, Barbara has grossly misrepresented what has gone on so far.
No, I have not.
It is not...
Barbara, excuse me, I have the floor. Barbara, only Craig has the floor right now.
I'm just not going to let him lie, that's all.
You can't interrupt
Excuse
him.
Excuse me.
You've got the floor. You're out of order, Barbara. Please continue, Craig.
Barbara has agreed on multiple occasions to debate Adam and me on the proposition a large plane was destroyed at the Pentagon.
No, only six months.
Oh, for God's sake. Can I please talk?
Barbara, if he has to have a chance to make his point, then you can be on the stack to talk and say your piece, okay? That's how it works, one at a time. Go ahead.
All right, look, I mean, I'm going to jump ahead here for a second here, and I'm going to point out that we have on the recording very clearly you saying that your position is a large plane hit the Pentagon. Or, sorry, was destroyed at the Pentagon.
It never is. Look at smoke curtains.
I don't need to look at smoke curtain. I'm looking at the teleconference and what was discussed on the teleconference.
Well, that is a misunderstanding then.
Oh, is it? Okay, let me read you a quote from November 22nd. And anyone can listen to this at 43 minutes and 30 seconds of that call after when you were making a comment on Wayne's presentation. You said, my hypothesis in smoke curtain, as I put it out in my emails to everybody, you can go look for it just before this call, is that it was a large plane that was destroyed at the Pentagon, just that it wasn't Flight 77 and it wasn't at the time or place on the wall that the official story states. You deny saying that?
Well, if I said it, what I meant to say was a plane that was mistaken to be a large plane.
You were mistaken several times, actually, because you said the same thing in January. And I can certainly quote you on that as well. That's from the January 27th call. And if people want to check out the recording from about an hour and 7 minutes in, we have Ken saying, can we state this in the affirmative that a large plane was destroyed at the Pentagon? And you said that would be fine. And then when the question was when someone questioned whether that was actually your position, the person said, I thought that the plane you were talking about was smaller. I didn't realize it was a large plane. And you said, absolutely not, a large plane. So you're trying to rewrite history here by saying
you were
didn't...
supposed to debate no large plane was destroyed at the Pentagon.
No. Sorry, this is irrelevant, okay?
No, it's not. You did not
point of order.
Your word.
Point of order. Ken.
Point of order. Yeah, point of order. Go ahead, Chris. Point of order.
This is irrelevant. The second debate took place before our agreement on the third debate. Okay? So Barbara made the agreement on the third debate after the second debate, which means she was okay with what happened in the second debate in terms of making an agreement for the third one. So to bring up something that happened before the agreement is irrelevant. Okay? I know what her opinion is because she said it about 15 times now in every possible forum she can manage to say it in. It's her opinion.
That is simply because Ken kept using the word large. I will not debate any proposition, but no plane was destroyed at the Pentagon.
Barbara, that's not the point here.
That is the proposition that matters.
Barbara, we're talking about what the agreement was only at this point, okay? He's trying to make clear that there was an agreement, and either he's telling the truth or he's not, but if he is, then that agreement was there.
He can say whatever he wants.
It's all on tape, Barbara.
Okay, look, you agreed to debate no large plane was destroyed at the Pentagon, and you didn't. Barbara, no, you can't say that. That's irrelevant. Okay?
It isn't irrelevant. He's trying to say that I don't agree to what I did, but he didn't agree to what he did. He didn't do what he agreed to.
Barbara, what we're discussing now is what happened regarding this current the debate that was supposed to take place today. We're not talking about previous debates, okay? Anything about
that's fine.
That,
I've already said that I will not debate no large plane with
we understand
the Pentagon
that, but that's not
because
what
I do not
okay.
believe
let's
it.
Let's let Craig continue with his presentation. Please continue, Craig, and please don't interrupt him again, Barbara.
Yeah, at the end, I would like to hear from Barbara that she has changed her position on this, because it's obvious that she has. And I would just like to know, because as I've said in different emails, Adam and I would have been absolutely fine with changing the question at any time, okay? Where we had a problem was that Barbara waited until July, after it was too late to make any more decisions about the July call. She'd made a decision in July that, well, this is what I'm willing to debate, as if it was all up for discussion. But it wasn't. It had been agreed, and it had been repeated on multiple calls. It was, and on top of that, she doesn't want to debate Adam Ruff now. She just announces as if it's entirely up to her that Adam's no longer included, even though Adam has been working on this with me for some time. And I don't think that that's fair.
Well, I don't think it's fair to have two people debate one person, ever.
Oh, really? Oh, then I'm sorry, but I'm going to quote you again, Barbara. Because
you can
from
quote
that,
all you want.
From the,
Barbara,
you can
please
quote
do not
all
interrupt.
You want.
Barbara, please do not interrupt. This is Craig Stern's talk. Go ahead, please.
On the same November 22nd call, I specifically asked whether anybody would have a problem with that. And frankly, I was expecting, I wouldn't have been surprised if somebody had said, no, I don't think that's fair. But I knew, originally, Adam and I both put our names forward, even before you did, Barbara. We were actually involved in this before you even got involved, okay? Now, one of us could have taken the reins, but I thought, well, I'll ask and see how people feel about the two of us sharing the duty. And if they object, well, then they object. But here's what you said. I raised it, I asked, and you said that would be just fine. You could have five people as far as I'm concerned, and you laughed. And then after that, Wayne was asked, and he said he'd have no problem with it. He said the most important thing is that we narrow the consensus and get to the truth. So everything was fine, and Adam's name has been mentioned probably more than half a dozen times on teleconferences with respect to this debate. And then you wait until July to suddenly it's like it's not fair. So to me, you're playing games. That's what it's the only way I can interpret
games.
It.
What you're leaving out is that Adam wrote a vicious ad hominem email about
in January. It didn't seem to bother you in January. It only bothers you in July.
It's unacceptable.
Really? Oh, is it? Okay. So why didn't you mention it before July? That's irrelevant again. It's irrelevant. People haven't read the email, and it's not relevant. If you had a problem with it in January, I'm sorry. If you had a problem with it in January, then you could
have raised it. I have a problem with
it
now.
Oh, you do?
Yes.
Okay. Well, you didn't ask. You didn't talk. When Ken sent out an email asking to clarify the last-minute details, you didn't even answer him. You went straight to the listserv and made a big long spiel. You didn't even have the courtesy of answering Ken's request for clarification on what your position was.
Yes, I answered it, but I sent it to
chair,
everyone so that everyone can
chair.
See.
Chair, can you step in?
Yes, who's raising a point? Somebody raising a point of order?
Yeah, this is Wayne. I think that we have to come to a vote on whether you want this discussion to continue. It's we're past our two hour mark,
and
it doesn't sound like we're going to resolve anything. And
okay,
so
you'd like to call the question on this part of the conversation. Does anybody have any objection to terminating the second part and then returning back to the first part of the agreed?
Yeah, I do actually. I think
this is
Wayne. I think that we need to call another question, that is to terminate this discussion on this call and cancel all the debates, discussions, because it's not relevant to moving us forward.
Okay, you're moving the previous question. So
No, that's not a, that's not an amendment on my seconded motion. It's not.
No, this is a request to the table. I don't know how to do that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You're moving the previous question. You're asking us to postpone both questions at this point. Is there a second to the motion to postpone?
Seconded.
Why should that take precedence over my existing seconded motion?
Because it's
two hours. It's time to stop.
No, she's asking a procedural question here. The answer is because these are privileged motions, okay? So they take precedence over the immediate business. So we have to put it to a vote. We have to find out whether the body would like to postpone it or whether the body would like to, continue the conversation. So all in favor of postponing both of these issues until another time. I'm sorry, of tabling.
I'd like to make an amendment.
The only amendment can be as to the time to which it is postponed. It cannot be about whether or not we postpone. Okay?
Well, I think that it should be fair to separate the two. There should be two questions.
Barbara,
my proposed proposal.
I'm sorry. The proposal was very clear. It was to take both questions off and put them on the table. And that's
and
what
I'm
we're voting on.
And I'm amending it to separate them, vote on them separately.
Okay. You're asking to divide the question. Okay.
Yes.
Now, Barbara would like to divide the question and... that only the second part of the conversation be tabled. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Oh, sorry. Aye. Okay. All opposed, say nay.
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 Okay. The nays carry, so therefore the question stays together. We are now going to vote on whether or not to table this discussion. All in favor of tabling the discussion, say aye.
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 All opposed, say nay.
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 That sounds pretty close. I guess we'll have to take a roll call vote on that.
I'm not clear what that vote was on, Ken. It's very unclear.
All right. I'll repeat the question. This is a question about tabling both of these questions. Putting both of these questions on the table. In other words, ending this discussion for now. Okay? So all in favor of ending both of these discussions right now, say aye.
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 All opposed to ending this discussion for the time being, say nay.
Nay.
Okay, well, that was much clearer. So I guess we're going to table this discussion. Anybody can ask to bring it up in the future, especially if you email in advance and let me know that you want to put it back on the agenda. So now we'll go on to announcements.
I'll put it back on the agenda for next time.
You have to send me an email. All right, so now we will go to announcements. Does anybody have any announcements? And in particular, if you have any local plans for commemorating the 9/11 events in your local area that you think might be of interest to the rest of us, we'd like to hear that. Anybody want to make an announcement?
Craig.
Craig. Anybody else? Okay. Craig, go ahead.
Yeah, I don't have the proper name in front of me here, but there's going to be a thing called the World Social Forum that's going on in Montreal in August, and one of the panel discussions at this conference is going to be about 9/11, and I don't have the title of the talk sort of handy, but it's going to have Graham McQueen, Neil Tarrant, and Elizabeth Woodworth will be all present and will participate in that. So I think, I'm not sure the exact date either, I should have written this down, but I think it's around the 10th of August, but I'd have to double check that, but it's the World Social Forum. I'll make sure it's in the minutes correctly anyway.
And where is it being held?
In Montreal.
Oh, in Montreal. Mm-hmm.
Okay, any other announcements before we close?
Yes, I'd like to make an announcement. This is Adam Ross.
Yeah, Adam, go ahead.
Well, it's nothing more than just a response to the accusation that I made an ad hominem attack on Barbara. I was critiquing her presentation, not the individual.
That's like not true. You said that I had stacked the deck in my state
I'm sorry, that's out of order because we've already agreed to postpone that conversation, but your comment is on the record. Okay, anything else?
Yeah, this is Wayne. I just want to let people know that the Christopher Bolin, as far as I know, is still doing a tour around the United States, and that he is going to be coming to the Hartford, Connecticut area, and we're going to be hosting him in early September, we think. Over.
Uh-huh. Okay. All right. Any other announcements? Okay. Hearing none, then I guess we'll I'll be back together again the last Wednesday in... I'm sorry? Is somebody trying to speak? Okay. Well, I'll be back together the last Wednesday in August, same time, same place. So see you then. Have a good summer. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.